US rule in occupied Earth, or everything you need to know about genocide but never knew to ask. Part 3. Lemkin's logic. The misuse of words is a key way to ensure that the ideological hegemony of the powerful is not disrupted when they commit acts that ordinary people find abhorrent. In 1936, George Orwell remarked upon this when he wrote, quote, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely in the defence of the indefensible. Things like the continuance of British rule in India, the Russian purges and deportations, the dropping of the atom bombs on Japan, can indeed be defended, but only by arguments which are too brutal for most people to face and which do not square with the professed aims of the political parties." End quote. A couple of years later, he famously satirized this as being what he called newspeak, a language of journalists and intelligentsia which systematically stripped the language of all meaningful terms and replaced them with good, bad, plus good, plus bad, double plus good, and double plus bad. A key aspect of using a concept of double plus good or double plus bad is that it cannot be argued against because it doesn't have a concrete definition. We do this in a low grade level as human beings because in our normal day-to-day lives because we're lazy and proud. We like to impress and to win arguments by using buzzwords in the place of thought. But at the higher levels of discourse, where you have societies combining together to create double plus bads and double plus goods, the use of language becomes systematically controlled in a way that shows clear purpose. The higher one's social ranking, the more constricted and controlled one's vocabulary, and hence thought. In part, this is due to conscious propaganda manipulation coming from government and corporate interests, which have long targeted the so-called opinion leaders with propaganda and left the message to trickle down, in the words of the US government's Vietnam Information Group, a propaganda outfit. Now, Orwell satirized this as being a party line, portraying it in 1984 as a centrally coordinated effort, but what he was really suggesting was that the system functions the same whether or not there is a central Politburo giving orders. The point is that the ideology is internalized, and the elites become their own and each other's thought police. This was what Orwell analogized as being constant surveillance and inescapable broadcasting. The unstoppable nagging of the television he portrayed in 1984 and the inescapable omnipresent surveillance in that novel were allegories for the internalized orthodox ideology. This was something that people carried around inside them, and they still do, of course. The actual centralized dissemination of ideology is a relatively crude matter, as the comparative failure of the Vietnam Information Group illustrates. In contrast to that, the decentralized co-optation of elites is more subtle, it's more profound, and it's far more robust. It harnesses people's own imaginations because they will actively try to fill in the gaps of facts and spin them in order to fit in with the internalized ideology. But more importantly, it harnesses their ability to avoid imagination and avoid thought. In real life, what this may mean is that a word that does have a definition has that definition suppressed, and people use the word as if there were no actual definition at all. Now, an obvious example of this is the word terrorism. The word terrorism is used in a manner that has little to do with any actual stable definition, excuse me. Originally, terrorism referred to advocating the use of terror during the French Revolution. It was actually put forward as a way of minimizing state violence because the emphasis on generating terror would maximize the disciplinary efforts of violence. In other words, if you scare the shit out of people, you don't need to kill as many of them to make them all behave the way you want to. This is an old idea, of course. It's very similar to the way the Romans used to run their armies, for example, with decimating them, killing every 10th person if there was if they failed in any way. In this case, the coinage of terrorism was just to give this old idea a sort of post-Enlightenment rationalization and make it all seem more official. That form of terrorism, you know, the same as what has been practiced going back to Roman times, is still very current everywhere that there is a military occupation. More broadly, though, terrorism came to denote a warfare technique where violence is used to terrorize the general population as a way of exerting pressure on a state power without having to inflict military defeats. You could call this asymmetric warfare, but of course it can be, it has been undertaken with mass bombing campaigns as well. And as a technique of asymmetric warfare, there is an obvious appeal, but it is actually usually counterproductive, and it is a gift to your enemies. Indiscriminate attacks, like the terror bombing campaign waged by Britain against Germany, tend to actually consolidate public support behind government and military leaders. In real terrorism, the regime that rules the target population generally benefits. Moreover, ever since there has been the asymmetric use of terror, state regimes have labelled all asymmetric warfare as terrorism. In fact, they have lumped in as many actions of their enemies under the category of terrorism as possible. And without exception, this is a way done as a way of garnering support for their own acts of terrorism, which they call policing, security operations, counterinsurgency, or counter-terror. Now, the use of the term counter-terror is quite interesting in itself because it actually allows states to overtly signal to their personnel that they should use terror tactics, but there is just enough linguistic slippage there to give them the deniability they need to, well, to deny that. In propaganda discourse, terrorism is never something that stands alone. You tie it to other things like ethnicity and religion. The Germans of the Third Reich were not induced simply to hate distinct groups of people. Their propaganda system, like ours, conflated plus bads and double plus bads to make them all seem like one great interlocked, multifaceted double plus badness. Criminals were bad. Perhaps deviants, maybe sexual deviants, who were decadent, devolved creatures, Jews or Jew-like, who were lefties and socialists and communists, and they want to destroy Germany. So the enemy was the criminal, queer, Jew, decadent, racial deviant commie. If someone was shown to be one, they were tainted with all the others because these ideas were so intrinsically interlinked in the discourse. And if they were demonstrably not, for example, homosexual, it didn't matter because in a more profound way, they actually were. They embodied the real essence of homosexuality rather than the mere outward form. And even though the Nazis related all of this to racial and cultural hygiene, the fact is that their most common immediate excuse for using violence against these chimerical enemies was terrorism. Germans used the concept of terrorism for exactly the same reasons as it is used now. One, because regimes like to pretend that terrorism threatens stability, the stability of the entire society, notwithstanding that actual terrorism does not generally destabilize regimes, even if it does disrupt society. Two, because Each individual will feel like they could be a victim. Terrorists are not going to stop to ask you your political opinion before they kill you. This makes people feel as if they are on the side of the government because they share a common enemy. And three, because calling people terrorists provides the all-important sense of reciprocity that makes state violence against the terrorists seem justified. Britain, France, Israel, and the US have all, just like Germany, used the label of terrorism to denominate entire populations as being terroristic in some essentialized way. This is used to make genocidal violence and terrorism against these populations seem justified. And one of the most striking examples of late, Israel just passed a law giving themselves permission to force-feed hunger strikers in the manner practiced by the US and recognized elsewhere as torture. This is the sort of force-feeding practiced at Guantanamo, for example. Telesur reports that Security Minister Gilad Erdan explained, quote, "Prisoners are interested in turning a hunger strike into a new type of suicide terrorist attack through which they will threaten the state of Israel," end quote. Which means, of course, he is saying that not eating is a form of terrorism. Now, once upon a time, academics would have at least kept in the back of their minds the notion that terrorism was a politically misused term. However, instead of translating that into publicly railing against the hypocritical misuse of the term by Western terrorist governments, their public contribution would more likely be along the lines of reminding people that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Well, like most fatuous clichés, this has the advantage of seeming thought-provoking whilst in fact being thought-killing. That was the typical liberal educated view, not to actually attempt to put things into a robust linguistic framework that could facilitate real analysis, but to imply that it's all a matter of opinion anyway, a kind of dead-end way of thinking and talking about something. As bad as that sounds, it all changed for the worse after 2001. Suddenly, there was a boost for academic security specialists, people who had perhaps been a little bit more marginal in terrorism studies and security studies, found that their way of defining terrorism, by taking people that they wanted to call terrorists and working backwards, was suddenly more prominent. The response from more level-headed academics was, of course, to immediately concede the middle ground to them and allow them to set the agenda. This meant that state terrorism, which was never incorporated into terrorism studies anyway, was now almost completely unmentionable. The idea that no definition of terrorism should prejudicially exclude a certain type of perpetrator is apparently alien to respectable scholars. Dissenting academics turned to so-called critical security studies and the new critical terrorism studies. But these are self-marginalizing positions, which by their very names tell us that practitioners do not study a thing, but rather study the way that the thing is discussed. The existence of something like critical terrorism studies necessarily embeds an orthodox terrorism studies. In practice, this provides a dual academic track wherein those who question what they are told voluntarily concede the greatest authority to those who are more inclined to parrot what they are told. To force those who use words like democracy and terrorism to only do so in accordance with a robust, fully contextualized definitional criteria would effectively deprive potential aggressors of potent tools against thought. This is just as true of the term genocide, but there is an additional significance to the term. A true understanding of genocide will do more than prevent its misuse as a way of eliciting a desired uncritical emotional response. So genocide-like democracy or terrorism can be used to make people have an almost Pavlovian response, either positively or negatively, in that they are, as I said, used to mean double plus good or double plus bad, which gets them to act in ways without thought. Then that is indeed the whole point. But genocide is even more significant than this because it differs as a concept in that understanding genocide will also strip away the ability for perpetrators, especially repeated perpetrators such as the United States of America, to conceal the immorality of their intents as well as their actions. The meaning and applicability of the term genocide not only belies the rhetoric of moral righteousness, wherein the US strikes for freedom and to protect the innocent from evildoers, but it also strips away the equally repulsive rhetoric of blunders, of inadvertence, and of self-driven systemic dysfunction. Applying the concept of genocide to US foreign policy reveals a conscious, systematic intentionality in a project that very few people would consider morally acceptable. And this is again goes back to what George Orwell said in The Politics of the English Language. You can justify these genocides, but not in terms that ordinary people would ever accept. But to apply the term genocide, we need to actually recover the original meaning, which is to say a stable meaning that doesn't contradict itself and can be reconciled with historical usage. To understand what genocide means, it's best to trace the thinking of Raphael Lemkin, who invented the term. Lemkin was a Polish Jew who was passionate about history. When he was a teenager, the Armenian Holocaust had a huge impact on him. This was understandably an emotional impact, but also it was a profound intellectual impact. He saw in these horrible events something related to the history of the persecution of Jews and the violence of pogroms. He became a lawyer, and in 1933 he advocated that new international laws be passed banning acts which would be considered crimes against the laws of nations. He proposed two new international crimes, which were, in brief terms, killing people on the basis of their ethnic, religious, or national identity, which he called barbarity, and the destruction of items of culture, places of worship, and so forth, which he called vandalism. Amusingly, in some ways, his collective term for these crimes of barbarity and vandalism was actually terrorism. But that's just a coincidence, really. Lincoln's genius was not, despite his intents, in naming a crime, but rather in naming a strategic behaviour. It would be better if genocide had never been thought of as a crime. Genocide is something that the powerful do to the weak, and despite the mythology, legal remedies do not work between parties of highly disparate power. Whilst people like to claim that laws are an equaliser that provides the weak with the tool to fight the powerful, that is not the historical experience of criminal law, nor of international law. In fact, it's not really the experience of civil law either. Power includes the power to police and enforce the law, and the power to defy law. And thus the law must always, to some extent, be obeisant to power. Admittedly, one can theorize a society wherein a social contract made all people equal before the law, such as posited by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, but in practice, that society would have to be one without any significant hierarchical differentiation. The hegemonic group in any society has always used different forms of law, including criminal law, against the lower classes, against ethnic minorities, or, when desirable, women, the LGBT community, religious groups, or people who hold undesirable political opinions. Law, in short, is inescapably predisposed to be a tool of the powerful against the weak. That is not to say that people cannot use the law for the benefit of the weak, but that is a function of individuals working against the general inclination of the system. The limits of laws can be demonstrated by a counterfactual thought experiment. Imagine if Lemkin had succeeded beyond his wildest dreams in 1933, and what we now have is the current UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide had actually been signed and ratified by all countries, including Germany, in 1933. Would that have impacted the passage of the Nuremberg race laws in 1935? Well, it didn't stop South Africa passing draconian pass laws in 1952, so one would have to say no. In fact, there is no way in which our historical experience of the UN Genocide Convention seems to suggest that it would have constrained Germany in any way at all. By the time the people in the Allied countries were reacting to German genocides with demands for actions, their governments were already at war with Germany. Moreover, their excuse for not acting against the infrastructure of extermination was the overriding need to win the war. And the argument that argument would not have been altered by the existence of a genocide convention. On the other hand, in 1938, the existence of a genocide convention might have actually strengthened Germany's claims that ethnic Germans were being persecuted in the Sudetenland and given more legitimacy to the Munich Agreement, which gave Germany the Sudetenland and left Czechoslovakia nearly defenceless against future German aggression. That is why it's actually a pity that Lemkin was a crusading lawyer, because his great insight was in inventing a theoretically rich term, which was the crystallization of considerable historical knowledge. The breakthrough he made was to realize that the violence that he had called barbarity and the destruction he had called vandalism could be reconceptualized as a single practice called genocide. This is absolutely fundamental to understanding what genocide means. Here is how Lemkin introduced the subject. Quote, "Generally speaking, genocide does not necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a nation except when accomplished by mass killings of all members of a nation. It is rather intended to signify a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of the essential foundations of the life of national groups, with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. The objectives of such a plan would be disintegration of the political and social institutions of culture, language, national feelings, religion, and the economic existence of national groups, and the destruction of personal security, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of individuals belonging to such groups. Genocide is directed against the national group as an entity, and the actions involved are directed against individuals, not in their individual capacity, but as members of the national group. The following illustration will suffice. The confiscation of property of nationals of an occupied area on the ground that they have left the country may be considered simply as the deprivation of their individual property rights. However, if the confiscations are ordered against individuals solely because they are Poles, Jews, or Czechs, then the same confiscations tend, in effect, to weaken the national entities of which those persons are members." End quote. So Lemkin's first example of an act of genocide is the confiscation of property from, quote, Poles, Jews, or Czechs. This is a concept in which mass violence against people's physical bodies is only one facet of a larger practice. In other words, when the Canadian government recently admitted to committing, quote, cultural genocide, they were truly not apologizing, but using slimy, evasive apologetics. There is no such thing as cultural genocide. There is only genocide. Pamela Palmater introduced her reaction thus, quote, "What happened in residential schools was not cultural genocide, it wasn't language genocide, and it wasn't almost genocide. What happened in residential schools was genocide. Canadian officials targeted Indians for assimilation and elimination purely for economic and political reasons." End quote. When Palmater wrote that she was merely introducing an extended argument, but she made a much more revealing comment, to my mind, about the nature of genocide when she was speaking on Democracy Now! Quote, "I know there was a focus on culture and that people were abused and beaten for speaking their language and culture, and they were clearly denied their identity. But for many of these children, upwards of 40%, they were denied their right to live. And that goes far beyond culture. Think about, at the same time, the forced sterilizations that were happening against Indigenous women and little girls across the country. Sterilization has nothing to do with one's culture, but in essence, the one's right to continue on in their cultural group or nation-based group. The objective was to get rid of Indians in whatever way possible. Culture was one aspect of it, but also denying them the right to live or to procreate was an essential part of this." End quote. The key sentence is, quote, "The objective was to get rid of Indians in whatever way possible." Palmater knows that does not mean the literal extermination of every single person that is even nominally Indian. What it means is erasing Indians from the places they are not wanted at that historical moment. As Lemkin wrote, quote, "Genocide has two phases. One, destruction of the national pattern of the oppressed group. The other, the imposition of the national pattern of the oppressor. This imposition in turn may be made upon the oppressed population, which is allowed to remain, or upon the territory alone after the removal of the population and the colonization by the oppressor's own nationals." End quote. This can be achieved through killing, assimilation, immiseration, or dispossession. This can be achieved through transmigration. The ancient Assyrians, the Atlantic slavers, and the Soviet Union all uprooted populations to weaken them by taking them away from their native soil. Equally, mass settler migration to US, to Aotearoa, to West Papua, to Tibet, to Palestine, it all imposes a new national pattern on the land. The connection to native soil has profound personal aspects that might be considered spiritual, cultural, or psychological, but let us not ignore the more immediate physical and concrete factors. Uprooting people utterly destroys their economic independence, which can seriously degrade social interconnections that help provide the essentials of life. Thus, the famous susceptibility that colonized people have to old world diseases has often struck when they are forced away from the land on which they rely for sustenance. People use the excuse of a purely biological fact, namely the lower efficacy of the immune response in populations that have not had generations of exposure to certain pathogens, to conceal the degree to which those who die of these diseases are often outright murder victims. When those who survive are relocated, it may be to camps, to ghettos or reservations that provide little for independent existence. In fact, the genocide perpetrator will place them in a subordinate and precarious position while exerting as much control over them as possible, whilst creating the greatest degree of appearance that the victim population are separate and autonomous. Once again, we are referring to the position of an included exclusion, but often with the pretense that the situation is the inverse, that the victims are autonomous and choose their own situation. All of this makes victim blaming much easier and allows further genocidal depredations to take place should the perpetrators discover the need for further dispossession. And another thing that, of course, happens is that they will often control populations by giving them material support to prevent immediate death after having deprived them of their ability to support themselves through subsistence, and then will claim that the victims are, of course, a drain on the charity and the benevolence of the perpetrators. And this is what is facing a number of West Australian Aboriginal communities currently. These communities are dependent on government supplying services, as are we all, but the cost of supplying services to Aboriginal communities will no longer be subsidised by the Australian federal government, and the West Australian state government is refusing to make up the shortfall. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said, quote, "What we can't do is endlessly subsidise lifestyle choices if those lifestyle choices are not conducive to the kind of full participation in Australian society that everyone should have," end quote. Well, that could be said about any rural community because they all cost more to provide services to. In fact, mathematically, there must always be places that cost more to provide services than average. And this same Western Australian government has just announced that it will be spending $32 million to upgrade rural water facilities that happen to be in the electorate of the Minister for Water. Abbott's words are particularly incendiary, though, because even if these are the traditional lands of the people living in these communities, when you look at the whole picture of colonisation in Australia, the most heavily populated and resource-rich lands are now full of the descendants of the settlers. The places that Aboriginal people can most easily maintain cultural autonomy and cohesion are those that were economically marginal to early settlers, and those places were generally more marginal and more sparsely populated by the indigenous people for exactly the same reasons. So they've pushed them into the less viable areas and then complain that they're demanding subsidies. Moreover, there is the fact that continued occupation of traditional lands may lead to the granting of native title in future. And you might think that 40,000 years is long enough to justify any such claim, but in legal terms, let's not forget that until 1967, Aboriginal people were actually counted as wildlife and not humans. Some of these communities might be economically underdeveloped, but if granted native title, they do happen to be adjacent to large amounts of mineral wealth. Many put this latest attack on Aboriginal communities in the context of the seven-year-old so-called intervention in the Northern Territories, which, as John Pilger has documented in the film Utopia, was based on lies and seems to have a lot more to do with exerting control over lands that are a potential source of strategic mineral wealth. If official Australia is trying to dispossess Aboriginal people as such from the land over which they want to exert control, it is genocide, just like the confiscations that were Lemkin's very first example of genocide. However, I don't want to overemphasise the significance of ethnic cleansing in a way that replicates the overemphasis on mass murder that is more common. As scholar John Docker puts it, Lemkin, quote, took great care to define genocide as a composite and manifold, end quote. Acts of genocide are interrelated and interlocking events that create a network through space and time. Genocide against Aboriginal peoples has at various times in various places meant extermination, enslavement, imprisonment, theft, fraud and impoverishment. Famously, the genocide of Aboriginal peoples also involved the so-called stolen generation of abducted children taken from Aboriginal parents and raised by so-called white Australians. The UN Genocide Convention specifically references the forcible transfer of children. This came from Lemkin's observations of the Germanization of other Caucasians. Lemkin and those who contributed to the wording of the Genocide Convention would have had a sort of denationalization in mind. Even though the abduction of Aboriginal children was occurring at the time that the convention was written, I don't think the people of the time really thought that it would apply to different racial groups, or at least those with a generally distinct appearance. They were talking about like a form of assimilation, in other words, that that isn't possible with people who have strikingly different pigmentation. Regardless of the rhetorical equivocations on the subject, though, nobody thought that Aboriginal children would actually become white just because they were raised by white parents or in white institutions. It's not a transfer into the hegemonic group. It was a transfer out of connection with others of the victim group. In fact, taking children was and is a way of trying to create that which all wielders of political power are innately inclined to want. They want to create human husks, ciphers who act only according to the stimuli given them. Taking children functions in the same way that transmigration or concentration functions. It strips agency and magnifies the power of the perpetrator over the bodily existence of the victims. It is intended to also provide control over the mental existence of the victims, usurping their decision-making and imposing the so-called rationality of the perpetrator. Now, there is a lot to unpack here. Genocide is actually the expression of a desire for complete power, a fantasy which is not unique to genocide at all. People become pure objects to be moved and used at will. Their own independent existence and agency is nullified, even to the point where if it is determined they are to die, it is achieved as if with the mere flick of a switch. This sort of power cannot be achieved without exerting destructive violence. For individuals, torture might be used to produce so-called learned helplessness in order to exert this sort of power over them. Genocide aims to exert this power over defined groups to try to impose the same condition of learned helplessness, which can indeed lead to extermination in the end, but extermination is not necessary. And genocide aims to exert this power over groups who are connected by familial relations. As with torture, the power relation that it creates and the violence in which it is expressed become the ends as well as the means. Now, I will relate this all back to mass murder and systematic annihilation in part 4, but first let me mention race. Race and racism are social constructs, but the important thing to realise is that racial discourse does not generate genocide. It may provide fertile ground for genocide, but the seed itself is from elsewhere. Genocide has a dynamic relationship with racism or other forms of group hatred. A significant part of that is the systemic inculcation of hatred in the the perpetrator population. That's far too many P's in two words, I think. Anyway, this is a very old part of warfare and genocide, generally signalled by leaders who promulgate atrocity propaganda. This propaganda might be a story about soldiers killing babies, or it could be about how the enemy leader's great-great-grandfather murdered an honoured ancestor. The idea behind it is that the intended perpetrators will view any of the intended victims as somehow linked to the crime, the atrocity used, in some essential way. The violence of warfare and or genocide naturally fuels the sense that membership in a group makes one guilty of the crimes of that group. In the former Yugoslavia, it has been found that ethnic animosities were generated by acts of genocide, not the other way round. This is true whether the animosity is towards the perpetrators or towards the victims. So if you are part of a group that is perpetrating genocide, you will have a driving need to hate the victims. This is because we are socialized in such a way that to see some from our group as the so-called bad guys in relation to the other is like an act of painful self-mutilation. It hurts, it maims, and it causes social death. And most people are simply not brave enough for that. The point is that genocide is not an expression of racial hatred as such, and it does not conform to the logic of racial thinking. If you believe that some undesirable trait or stain is carried in the blood or in the genes, according to racial theories, it makes no sense whatsoever to transfer children from the victim population. Hitler appeared to be conscious of this, at least in the case of Jews. In a letter to Martin Bormann, he wrote, quote, "We use the term Jewish race merely for reasons of linguistic convenience, for in a real sense of the word, and from a genetic point of view, there is no Jewish race. Present circumstances force upon us this characterization of the group of common race and intellect, to which all of the Jews of the world profess their loyalty, regardless of the nationality identified in the passport of each individual. This group of persons we designate as the Jewish race is above all a community of the spirit. Spiritual race is more solid and more durable than natural race. Wherever he goes, the Jew remains a Jew." End quote. This is the other face of the coin revealed by Pamela Palmater in the quote above. The objective was to get rid of the Jews in whatever way possible. Not because of some singular property of Jews, but because of the entire multiplicity of everything that created the group identity of Jews. With Native Americans in Canada, and with Jews in Germany, the object was to efface a group as such in order to allow the expansion of the hegemonic national identity. For Hitler, this was philosophically linked with group will, but the same conclusions can be reached by your average prosaic, greedy white supremacist who wants to get their hands on mineral resources or votes or an expanded tax base or whatever. But Hitler's genocidal activities and intents did not stop at the borders of Germany or even Greater Germany. He wasn't just attacking an internal minority, he was also attacking ethnic and national groups outside of Germany's borders for the purposes of imperial expansion. And he was doing so using the same process, the process of genocide. We have so overemphasized the concept of genocide as being an attack on an internal minority that even genocide scholars write about Jewish victims of the German genocide as if they were a German minority. For Lemkin's memory, this is doubly abusive because he was a Polish Jew, as were half of the Jews killed by Germany. Lemkin's prime exemplar of genocide, when he coined the term, was Poland. He mentioned many victim groups, including Jews, but the most commonly cited group he used to demonstrate what he called the techniques of genocide were the Poles as such. He understood that Jews were slated for annihilation, but genocide had to be shown as a much broader phenomenon. In genocide, what is attacked is the sum of all those things that make the victim group a group. We don't have a term for this thing. And at the risk of creating confusion, I'm going to label the entire collection of the inherent connections that provide a group identity, I'm going to label that it's demotic, and I think that the unique essence that is created can be referred to as the demotic idiom. I do this to ground the terms by reference to a complex but concrete phenomenon, that of language, but I also want to make reference to the concept of the demos, because genocide is a strategic response to demographic circumstances. Genocide can be thought of as a demostrategic phenomenon. A demos, of course, is the Greek word for the crowd, the mass. When we get, we derive from that democracy, demographic, and so forth. So the demotic of the group, and the demotic is reference to the language of the masses, but in this term, I'm using it here in the way I just identified as being the sum total of what makes the group, right? So the demotic of the group is what is attacked in genocide. It is aimed at the victim group, the genos, as such. Thus, the demotic is all of those things which make the group as such. And those things contribute strength and richness to the demotic idiom, that is, the uniqueness of the group. This would be things like individual and collective property, folklore, places of worship, sports stars, social welfare programs, poets, statuary, language, public transport infrastructure, to just name a few random things. For convenience, I'm going to ignore weaknesses and say that anything that contributes in any way to the group identity as such is part of the demotic and is therefore potentially a target of genocide. You can attack an entire group by killing a single poet, for example. Lemkin didn't really quite understand the implications and breadth of genocide. Instead of what I've referred to as the demotic, he referred to a biological aspect, to what had previously been called denationalization. He specifically referenced the fact that Hitler viewed biology in essentialist terms. Quote, Hitler's conception of genocide is based not on cultural but biological patterns. He believes that Germanization, he's quoting Hitler here, so he believes that, quote, Germanization can only be carried out with the soil and never with the men, end quote. And that's end of Hitler's quote and Lemkin's quote. Therefore, there is a contradiction between the public Hitler of Mein Kampf, which Lemkin is quoting there, and the private Hitler, confessing to Bormann that he doesn't actually believe the literal truth of those words. In fact, there is no biological aspect. Genocide, in that sense, is a misnomer. What Lemkin had mistaken for biology or for biological was actually the familial aspect of the demotic. Racial ideology and differences in phenotype notwithstanding, a genos is actually a social construct. It is a socially constructed demographic entity, and it is reproduced primarily through child rearing. The family is where language, customs, and the simple fact of self-identification are passed to the individual by their parents and other relatives. Moreover, even beyond the fundamental inscribing of group character on the individual, without which the group would not even exist, the familial interconnection carries through in later life. Connections with family form the closest social bond, and almost always individuals share group membership in the genos with those relatives with which they share the most significant social bonds. Inevitably, then, familial interconnections correspond with biological structure and genetics and are the most significant sustenance of the demotic idiom. So, in fact, it's just a coincidence that these social structures reflect a so-called biological aspect. Genocide scholars emphasize the fact that it is the way the perpetrators define the group that is important, not the way the victims self-identify. Here is where we run into what seems to be a problem, because perpetrators tend to define victims in biological racial terms. Actually, I should mention there's another problem as well, because, of course, that emphasis on how you the perpetrator defines the group can also be another way of hypocritically exonerating Western perpetrators whilst pointing the finger at third world perpetrators. But that's beside the point here, because the problem I want to discuss here is that perpetrators seem to use racial terms to define the victim group. However, it can be that someone's life is spared on the basis that they don't display the racial characteristic which the perpetrators claim to identify, use to identify the victim group. But then again, sometimes it's not. Ultimately, the racial hygiene pretensions of some genocide perpetrators must be treated as hollow, because the biological pretensions of the racial discourse below that are hollow and unstable. No genos can actually be identified by so-called race. The nature of human diversity is such that even the originating defining character of a genos is unstable. In fact, the hard defining lines that may form around a genos tend to be in reaction to racism and persecution and genocide. That's when they become enclosed and develop boundaries. It's those things that prevent pluralistic integration and, you know, the sort of common evolution of a more pluralistic society. Anyway, I think I'm drifting away a little bit from the central points about genocide, even though the problematics of identity are very important. But getting back to the demostrategic logic of genocide, there are several prominent motives for committing genocide, but in reality they're not as distinct as people might think. A settler colony that wishes to cleanse the land of the indigenous people is ultimately trying to achieve the same thing as an imperial power that wishes to crush an insurgent people, which is much the same thing as a nationalist state that wants to erase a discordant minority and exert greater control through uniformity. The point is that all of these are undertaken by visiting destruction on what I've termed the demotic idiom, in the form of violence against the people and the destruction and degradation of those aspects of existence which collectively provide substance to the group. Now, I will continue this in part 4, which is entitled You Are Next.